Welcome to the New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, the New Mind Creator. Today I'll be interviewing Dick Wybro. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so that you'll receive alerts when new episodes are available on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Also, please leave me a 5-star review on iTunes or Spotify. Where did you grow up and how did you go about becoming a stand-up comedian?
I was born in Canada, and then when I was about 9 years old or so, my father's a New Zealander, and he had always wanted to go to the U.S., and when he initially tried to go to the U.S. in the late 60s, they were like, oh, we got too many Kiwis. Go to Canada. They'll take anybody. And so we were up in Canada, and he always wanted to go to the United States. And so when I was about 9 years old, he moved the family down to the U.S., and so I was I was a chubby red-haired Canadian boy dropped into Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. Ooh. And that's baptism by fire, brother. That so from there we ended up moving to the Midwest, to Minnesota, and I spent most of my formative years in Minnesota. But same sort of thing. So I was a shy kid. And I had to learn my way how to be able to, I guess, find a way into the world. And so a lot of that came from the writing and humor. I fell in love with humor. I used to memorize entire albums of comedians. I mean, growing up with, you know, in the 80s, all my friends and me were listening to like heavy metal music and stuff like that. So here's me with my my rock t-shirt with the sleeves ripped off of it. But on my tape player that I'm listening to George Carlin and Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby, all these guys, where everybody else is listening to the heavy metal music. And so I really fell in love with humor, if for no other reason, being kind of a shy kid when there were confrontations. I discovered early on that humor is a bit of a power shift. For one, humor is voodoo. It's just an amazing sort of thing. It's so amorphous, and sometimes you laugh at something and don't really know why that thing is funny. And so I really became a student of that, try to learn that. And also, on a personal level, humor was an opportunity for if I had any sort of confrontation or any scenario that I felt that I was out of control, being funny was a way to regain that kind of control. You know, it's a power shift.
Yes. And you mentioned you were a shy kid.
Yeah.
Did you always have the confidence to be a comedian?
No, I still don't have the confidence today. No, there's something funny about confidence. And this is something every now and then somebody will ask me about, this idea of getting into stand-up comedy. And I always tell them, it's like, as long as you project confidence, there's a funny thing about it. So you're going to go out on stage. If you're projecting confidence, the audience looks at you, and not arrogance, that's very different, but confidence. The audience looks at you, goes, well, this guy looks like he knows what he's doing. And then they have confidence in you, and as sort of an irony, that gives you confidence. So coming there thinking, I can do this, the audience goes, well, he can do this. And then you end up getting a bit of their confidence in you, and that lifts you up. And so kind of BSing your way into it, the old fake it till you make it, it does work. And that's something that gave me confidence on stage and to do some of the things that I do.
So was comedy your first quote-unquote job?
Yeah, so it was my first love. My first job was working at McDonald's, and there's no comedy there. But that was just so I could buy a bike. But no, I ended up getting into comedy. It was the beginning of a lifelong quest to avoid proper work. Because when you do stand-up comedy, sure, there's a lot of work, but your work day is 45 minutes long. That's a good work day. That's none of this 8-hour stuff. 45 minutes up on stage. So that's fantastic. So yeah, I loved that, going out there and entertaining crowds. But that all stemmed from the writing side. because when I was younger in my teens, I was trying to become a writer. I'm a full-time author now, but I was trying to become a writer. And it was really difficult, especially in the 80s, pre-internet, to be able to send out short stories or books to publishers and wait those weeks and months to get the inevitable rejection, because you get a lot of rejections. And in fact, back in those days, you had to take and you had to put a self-addressed stamp envelope into your pitch to them. So basically, you were paying for the stamp that they could reject you on. And I got in a stand-up because I love stand-up comedy, but I had in my mind, this made sense at the time, in my mind, if I write something that afternoon and get on stage that night, I'm published. Do you know what I mean? So that yes. was an hours long process to get published. And that was really rewarding for me. So I did that for a couple of years, solely not even because I wanted to get up and talk in front of an audience, but because I wanted to write stuff, jokes or stories, because a lot of stuff I did was storytelling. When I write stories that people could appreciate and I could feel some of that love come back from somebody who's enjoying the story that I created that afternoon.
Did you have any doubters? Did everybody in your immediate vicinity believe in you when you were saying, okay, I want to be a writer, I love doing stand-up comedy?
You're always going to have doubters, especially when you decide to do something that's out there, right? So my career has been stand-up comedy, rock radio jock, a television producer, and now as an author. And when you decide to swing for the fences like that, you're always going to have people that doubt you. But I'll tell you what, Maurice, I welcome those people. I appreciate those people, because when I'm lying in bed, because I struggle with sleep, I have narcolepsy. And so I'm always, always sleepy. But so if I'm lying in bed and if I'm thinking, oh, I don't want to get up and start writing today, I remember those doubters. I remember the words that they said. I remember the derision. And that makes me go, you're right. You know what? I'm going to prove you wrong. And I use them like fuel. And they helped get me out of bed because I want to prove them wrong. And I did that through stand-up and radio and television producing all through along the way. Luckily, now I don't have as much of that anymore. Because when you get a bit of a track record, after a while, those doubters do begin to fade away. But you still have them. I mean, the bigger you get, you have specific doubters and their voices are louder. But I don't see that as a negative anymore. I use those people as a fuel. For my success.
So did you naturally begin using the negativity, the doubters as fuel, or was that just something, I don't know, developed or given to you?
No, I don't think it was given to me. See, I grew up with, my father was a New Zealander, and Kiwi white boys, they don't know how to express themselves, man. I don't know what it is. I love living in New Zealand, but there's something about Kiwi white boys, and this isn't against them. This isn't a slam on them. They grew up in an environment where you're not supposed to put your head up, right? There's something called tall poppy.
Heard of it.
It's brutal. It's awful. And so I feel for some of these folks here. Now, the folks with, the brown people here, they didn't have that as much. And they're the loveliest, most wonderful people on the planet. I love hanging out with my brown people here in New Zealand because they just let it all hang out and they're great. But so no, I grew up with a Kiwi father. And so like, for example, I'll give you an idea, Maurice, when I first went and did stand-up comedy, my father came and saw me do stand-up and I had a very good set. And so I ended up coming out and I said, so what did you think? And his answer was, well, it's something you always wanted to do. Well, yeah, but what did you find it funny? Did you like it? Well, this is something you've wanted to do since you were a kid. And so I realized that that didn't even bother me at the time because I had grown up with somebody who wasn't my cheerleader. And so early on, I had support from mom, I had to learn how to become my own cheerleader. And so I don't know how that transformed. Maybe it's something that was sort of inherent inside of me. I don't know what it was. Or just being being kind of dumb enough, because as young men, we're all stupid. We're stupid. And many of us never grow out of that. I probably haven't grown out of that. But I was too dumb to realize I couldn't do stuff. Thankfully, none of the stuff I did was lethal. The stuff I did was just sort of out there, like the stand-up comedy and the rock radio stuff. So I had always seen the detractors as, and maybe at some part ego of like, oh yeah, well, let me show you. And so that's always kind of been a part of me. So I guess in that sense, I've been quite lucky. I don't know. And I wish I could tell you where that came from, other than just being a bit dumb as a kid and thinking I could pull this stuff off.
Yeah. And how did you get into radio?
So stand-up comedy, it's like anything in any of this stuff. Like, you take a look at the market. And had you asked me about the market when I was, you know, in my early 20s, I would indeed not even know what that meant. But I could actually see, because right in the early mid-90s or so, what had happened was stand-up comedy started showing up on television. Television channels started to realize that all you needed was a microphone, a fake brick wall, put a guy or girl in between those two things, and you got programming. You got cheap programming. So then you started to see stand-up comedy all over. A&E had it. USA Network had it. Every channel had it. The Food Network, I think, had a stand-up comedy show because it was cheap programming, because you didn't have to pay writers or anything like that. It's just a three-camera setup. So that affected crowds coming out to gigs. And so I started to see fewer and fewer people showing up to the clubs. And so I was like, well, how do I take what I've learned in, you know, working on the mic and move into radio? And so I had done some radio shows and I spoke to people. And this is always sort of, you know, I was speaking to someone just last night about, because they wanted to get into radio. And what I did is I just spoke to people who were already in radio. And I said, hey, I kind of want to do what you do. I'm not asking for a favor. I'm just asking for some insight on what that's like. And so I spoke to a number of folks. And I was willing to start at the bottom. And I started, Maurice, I started at the bottom. I went down from Minneapolis down to 2.5 hours south of Kansas City. And I did a morning show at a country radio station in El Dorado Springs, Missouri. This station was so small. When I would, it was a converted farmhouse, the radio station, and I would have to show up in the morning and literally turn the radio station on. Outside of the back door was the tower. I think it was like a 1200 watt radio station. There was this tower behind me as I broadcast. And so I'm convinced I was probably getting hair cancer or something the entire time that I was broadcasting. But so I did that. And like many of these things, I just went from market to market. In radio, the way you get a raise or you do better is you leave. Which is probably the case in a lot of business ventures. So I ended up going from there to another station in Missouri. Then I did Orlando, then Pensacola, and then Southern California. And then from there, ended up doing Atlanta, which is major market radio. And that was my last gig in radio, doing a rock station in Atlanta, Georgia, which was fun, which was a great time. But I ended up transitioning into that because I saw that I could see the writing on the wall. I was like, this is going to take a bit of a dip and I need to get out before it pushes me out. And I hopped before I was forced to jump and I landed on my feet.
You mentioned earlier having narcolepsy.
Yeah.
How has that affected you and the things that you do? Because you said you're always tired. It seemed like it would be easy for you to give up and blame, okay, I have narcolepsy. That's why I don't have enthusiasm to do anything.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When I first got diagnosed with narcolepsy, I wasn't even seeking that. The woman who I was married to at the time, she actually went in, she was convinced she had various little ailments. And so we ended up going into a doctor because she was saying, I have narcolepsy. And so I went with her to the doctor. And so I'm standing up there, leaning up against the door jamb. And she's speaking to the doctor in front of me. And anytime that, you know, I needed to fill in a bit of information about her, what's going on with her, I would chime in when asked. So then the doctor turned to her. And I tell you what, Maurice, this is exactly the scenario. The doctor turned to her and said, I don't think you have narcolepsy. Then he looked over at me and went, but I think he might. And I was like, what? And I'm not here for me. So then the following week, I ended up going to their clinic and I lay down into one of their beds, and they put the suckers on my faces, all over my face, you know, the little EKG and everything. And they watch me as I slept and took video, and then wake me up every hour, give me a quiz, which probably only made the narcolepsy worse. They kept waking me up. I'm trying to get some sleep here. And and I had to pay them like $250 for this sort of thing, which in retrospect, I take a look now. There's people that have Twitch channels. They've got YouTube channels that you pay them to watch you sleep. So if I take a look, that clinic probably owes me about $275. Now I think about it, because they watch me all night long. But so after that, I had a thing. So this thing that I had my entire life, that I was sleepy, and it was only my perspective. I didn't know that everybody didn't have this, but now I had a name for it. That thing you have that makes you sleepy all the time, you're tired and out of gas, that's narcolepsy. So yeah, you go through that initial stage of like, well, that's not fair. Why did I get narcolepsy? And then you start to realize there's a lot of people that have it a lot worse than you. And so, but now that I had a name for it, I started to think that maybe this is something that's not that bad. Yes, it's troublesome to be sleepy all the time. And I'm talking to you right now, Maurice. I have to laser focus while I'm speaking with you. And you probably can't even hear it. But as you and I are speaking, I'm actually shuffling cards. It's something that keeps my mind focused. So I've got a deck of cards right in front of me. And I shuffle these right below the microphone, because it's something that keeps my mind focused so I can keep pushing forward. Because if I fade away too much, you and I will be speaking and I wouldn't be paying attention anymore. I'll be talking and I'm not even really there. But I'll tell you what. So after the first couple of years of going, woe is me, I started to realize that so much of this creativity that I have, I think, came from this condition. And how I explain it to people is, you know those moments where you lie down at night and just as you're about to drift off to sleep, you get some of these amazing ideas. You think, wow, that's really great. I should write that down. That's really good. And then you fall asleep and you wake up the next day and you don't remember it. And you didn't write it down. And so it's gone. But that interim space where you're falling asleep, that creative space where you get those amazing ideas, I'm there about 85% of my day. And so I now see narcolepsy as a superpower. I sincerely do. Because that's where a lot of this creativity comes from. I really believe that a lot of the creativity that I have and the stories that I write and the creativity I've had over the years has come from being in that thoughtful sort of dreamlike state. And so now I wouldn't say I'm happy to have narcolepsy, but I do believe that it is a font of creativity for me. And so now I embrace it. It's just part of my life and I accept it.
That is amazing, because that is the gateway to your subconscious mind. That's 100%. When your conscious mind is at ease, when we get closer to that sleep-like state. And you're literally tapping into that often, but you don't view it as a negative, because it seems like it would be frustrating if I can't sleep and get the rest that I really want to. And I'm always, you know, having these breaks, waking up and so forth, and you're really embracing it, but that's the subconscious mind you're tapped into.
Yeah, and that takes a conscious decision, because you can either say this sucks and fight against it and choke caffeine down and all this sort of thing. And I had done that in the past. But I think that the moment you accept, you go, this is a scenario. This is the hand I've been dealt. And so what can I do with this? And so now, And more recently, in the last 10 years or so, I've made others around me more aware of the narcolepsy, because there are times where I might drift off while someone's talking and I want them to know, listen, it's not just because you're boring me. You might be, but it's not because you're boring me. It's just because this condition I have. Because there was a period of time in the beginning that it was kind of embarrassing to have something, because some describe narcolepsy, and I only have my perspective, I don't know that, but somebody described narcolepsy to me, for somebody who doesn't have it, is stay up for 30 hours, now go to work. And now when you're done with work, come home and make dinner for the family, and then sit down and talk with your spouse. And that's how they've described what an average person might feel like with narcolepsy. But I'm like that all the day. So I've sort of got mental tricks and stuff to try and keep myself awake and focused, as I mentioned with some of the cards. But I do now appreciate when those sort of hazy theta moments kind of happen, because that's where I believe that's where a lot of my creativity comes from. So yeah, so I've embraced it.
You've literally turned lemon into lemonade, like,
yeah,
big time.
Yeah. And it's paid off in dividends. You know, I've been very lucky. and I will accept that. I've also, you know, you create your luck, but I mean, I got to be a stand-up comedian. I got to have an amazing time as a broadcaster in rock radio and had so much fun doing that. And then even with the television producing and now as an author, I get to lead a fun life. And a lot of that came from accepting that this is a situation I've got. How do I turn it in my favor? So it's paid off. That and a fair amount of luck along the way.
And you write, you mentioned you write novels, like best-selling novels.
Yeah.
What are some of your favorites that you've written? I know all of them, you could say. Mm-hmm. What are some of your top-selling novels?
If you ask any author what's your favorite novel you've written, they'll always say the most recent one. That's it's just the one that you're into the most. Yes. The most fun I'm having right now is this new Kane series that I started this year. And then there's the third book coming out near the end of December. But that's a blast. I mean, Kane is, and like I said, a lot of the inspiration comes from, I believe, some of the narcolepsy in that dream state. But Kane is about a wolf who gets bitten by an infected man and wakes up the next day and he's human. Mm. But then when the moon comes out, he transforms into a werewolf and occasionally various types of dogs. And so now the book is about, or the series is about, how he's searching for the guy who bit him to unlock the secrets that will help him transform him back into a wolf. Because he's been a human for a year. He's this big 6'7" French Canadian because this lovely couple took him in and taught him about being a human. And there's a story behind that. But he spent a year learning how to be a human and has lived in our world and went, I want to be a wolf again. I don't want to be a human. I want to be able to run free in the woods naked and just have it. He could do that as a human, but he'd probably get incarcerated and very likely frostbite, very unfortunate frostbite if he tried that sort of thing. And there's a real, if you want to hear it, there's kind of a fun story about how book three sort of came together. And part of this, because we always lament about how, you know, social media is bad. And there are certainly negative parts of social media. But I've had such amazing conversations and interactions with people, with readers. You know, back in the day, like I mentioned, when you would send out your self-addressed stamped envelope. Nowadays, all that stuff happens in a snap, right? But I've had some amazing conversations for readers, and one that really sticks out, and it's affected this book three that I just finished that's coming out later this month. But I get reader groups every now and then. They'll say, hey, listen, we've all got together, read the book. We'd love to talk with you. And so I'll Zoom in and chat with them. And I've chatted with people in the U.S. and Canada and the U.K. And so this is such a lovely thing. I love this. So I was chatting with some folks in the United Kingdom. And all that morning, I had been a bit frustrated because I was starting book three, and I'm what's called a discovery writer or a pantser. I don't really necessarily know where the story's going. I let the characters kind of tell me. And so I'd taken a break from that to talk with this this reader group in the UK. And this woman from, I say New Brighton. She might have said New Brighton, but now I just say she's from New Brighton because I kind of think it sounds cool. If you're from New Brighton, you may totally disagree with me. To me, it sounds like it's a cool place. But she says, you know what? I love the story. I love everything we're learning about Kane and about his partner, Imelda. I can't wait to find out more about when he was growing up with those human parents, as he calls them, that the year he spent on the farm up there in Canada. And once she said that, I was like, of course, that's exactly what I'm doing in book three. I'm going to talk a bit about how he grew up with those people. But what was so lovely about that was just, you know, there might have been a time 20 years ago when I would have been like, no, my toy, you can't play with my toy. But I've realized that you take that inspiration when it comes in. And you recognize that this is an input. You don't have to take all of it. But this lovely woman from New Brighton told me, somebody who loved the story, said, I would love to hear more about this. And I went, you're exactly right. That's exactly what I should be doing in this book. And so she influenced, and I've spoken with her about this since. She's lovely. But she influenced a large portion of this book. And that's just such an amazing thing, because as an author who sits in a tiny room in Auckland, New Zealand at 4 a.m. writing stories, to connect with this woman 10, 12, 15,000 miles away. And, you know, and we find that human connection, and it can help create something that I hope is something that people around the world can enjoy. That's a lovely thing about our technology. There's so many negatives, but it does have an opportunity to bring people together that never would, and create moments like that.
What is your one to grow on? What valuable piece of information would you like to leave our audience with?
I would like to say that for as much as I've been talking about talking stand-up comedy and radio, and you and I have been talking, I think there's so much value in listening to somebody like that woman from New Brighton. You know, I could have steamrolled over her. And like I said, some years ago, I might have done something like that, where I might have been, oh, that's really sweet that you've said that. But I think when we listen to other people, we spend so much time when you're talking, like if you're talking to your spouse or your friend or somebody at work, we spend so much time waiting for their lips to stop moving so we can get our point across. And all I'm saying is I found so much joy in trying not to do that. I fail at that as much as I succeed. But on the moments where I just listen, really, really listen to what the other person is saying and support what they're saying and be into what they're saying in this particular moment, that lifts them up, because we don't listen to each other anymore. We're always trying to get our point in. But if you listen to somebody, if you really take and concentrate and listen to somebody and hear what they're saying and support that and be into what they're talking about, it makes them feel good. It makes them feel heard. You can even find solutions on occasion that way. But I find that when I do that with people, lifts them up, it actually makes me feel great too. And so sometimes the best conversations you can have are the conversations that you don't say a whole lot. You listen to them and support them. And I think if we did more of that, I really think that individually our lives would be pretty great, but also it would make the world a better place. So.
Thank you for listening to The New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, The New Mind Creator. Today's episode has been sponsored by Abundant Sports and True Serum.